regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, the Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced, thousands of books have been written, and yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, and 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is. And that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. This is Beth. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. How are you, everybody? I just returned last evening, bedtime, from a long journey. I was in Holly, Pennsylvania, and I went to a spiritual retreat. I actually went to visit my Sadguru, who's working with us with disclosure in connection with the Galactic Federation and all that is. He's an inspired being who is connecting with us on our journey for disclosure and helping along the way. I'd like to read to you about him, and the reason is because I would like to invite you to the next retreat. I hope many of you listening will join me there. Sri Swami Purna is a descending soul or divine incarnation. Even in India, beings of such spiritual stature are extremely rare. He has chosen to remain outside of public eye for most of his life, inspiring and guiding seekers and world leaders alike from behind the scenes. It is little known that many of the 20th century's greatest, most revered, and best known spiritual masters have, at one time or other, sat at his feet and received his blessing and guidance. He has acquired complete mastery of the many aspects of worldly life, giving him a unique capacity to guide and inspire people of every background and stage of life in their journey towards wholeness. As such, he is a bridge to the infinite, guiding the seeker back to their own unrealized potential. The divine grace radiates through him without restriction. To hear his teachings in the spirit of openness, humility, and the wish to evolve is therefore to establish a perennial link with the eternal presence within and as one's own self. As he himself has said, the only reason I have manifested in duality is to help you. His blessing has been the defining point in our lives of many seekers of truth. Moreover, his wisdom is not restricted to any method or tradition of growth, but rather touches all aspects of human condition and encompasses every genuine spiritual pathway and leads to freedom and fulfillment. His level of mastery has earned him the title in India, Vidya Vakaspati, Lord of Learning, adept at many forms of alchemy and the highest yogic secrets. Swamiji is the Mahasiddha, perfect being, having attained the state of agelessness. His profound teachings and his playful, joyful manner make the spiritual path simple, practical, inspirational, and accessible to all who wish to realize their full potential. He teaches the way to lead a healthy, balanced, and fulfilled life, and for those who are ready, he shows the way to liberation in this lifetime. As late Prime Minister of India, Morarji Desai, once said, "There are many gurus who have found fame in the West, but Swami Purna is one of the very few who are also greatly revered in India." This is the one who has been guiding me for the past several years in my work with Disclosure and the work on Galactic Roundtable. And many of you say, you know, you notice that I have high energy and I'm able to accomplish many things, and it's under his guidance that I've been able to do that. I had a wonderful retreat. It was very fruitful, and my part of it was deeply focused in Disclosure. And now that I've been there to visit, I feel that Disclosure is coming sooner than any of us thought. The next celebration I'd like to invite you to with him, if those words resonated with you and inspired you, maybe you'll hear the call and come visit and join in next time. We will be celebrating the Guru Purnima celebration, which is a tradition in India where in the month of August, during the full moon, the great gurus of India are celebrated then. And they have celebrations all over the world during the month of August for the gurus. And His Holiness Sri 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 Swami Purna Maharaj is holding a celebration on the 25th of August until the 27th of August in Holly, Pennsylvania. And I'll read this to you. It says, "Dear beloved friends, we are very happy to provide the dates of our August 2013 Guru Purnima retreat and His Holiness Sri 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 Swami Purna Maharaj. The August retreat with Sri Swamiji is incredibly special as we celebrate the glory of the Guru and the presence of grace in your life. At the very auspicious time of the year known as Guru Purnima, the retreat will begin first thing on Sunday morning, the 25th of August 2013, and will finish at the end of the afternoon on Tuesday, the 27th of August, 2013. The retreat will be held at Lucan's Farm Resort in Holly, Pennsylvania. This is an opportunity not to miss, so we are sending the dates far in advance for your planning and preparations. It is most advisable to wait and not make your travel arrangements until we send a formal invitation. In the meantime, feel free to email us with questions to events@purnasvarup.org. I'll post this information on Galactic Roundtable so I don't have to read it here. So look for that. I hope if you feel inspired that you'll be there in August. It's going to be a very special year. I would love to meet you then. An announcement I have to make today is that I'm holding a class for extraterrestrial contact tonight. And we will be doing four classes in the month of April. This is the first one. And each one will build on the last. So if you'd still like to meet with us tonight for this first class, then there's still time to sign up. The class will be at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. The cost is $44. And there is a sign-up, a registration at galacticroundtable.co. galacticroundtable.co. And the description of the class is, "This class is for folks of all experience levels. Each class will be part lecture and part lab. This lecture will cover meditation, mantra, and intention. I will discuss each and give pointers for more effective practice. During lab this day, we will attempt contact on the etheric plane. I will facilitate an initiation with transmissions through guided imagery to take you to a point in space. This day we will contact the Great White Brotherhood on Sirius. Some will indeed have contact this first time out. Others may practice the techniques taught this day and have success of etheric ET contact after a bit of practice. Each class will be taught on a conference call. After you register, then the phone number and conference code will be emailed to you. So that's just a reminder for tonight. The next class is on Saturday, April 20th, and the following one is Tuesday, April 23rd, and the next will be April 27th on Saturday. And I'll repeat these series of four classes later on. They'll be the same series of four next time I do it. So let's see where we are. There's a new letter out from M.T. Keshe. We have been studying his work. He is an Iranian nuclear physicist, and he is the one working with Ashtar who has the advanced technologies to be released on Ashtar's command when it's time. And he's sharing a new letter with us, and it's an update, so I'd like to share that with you now. You can find his work at KeshiFoundation.org. See, the copy I have for this isn't clear. Let me pull it up a different way. 1 second. All right. New era. This letter I write in a simple style so that there are no misunderstandings and there is no need for anyone to interpret the meaning and purpose of releasing this information. This letter has the same meaning for all creatures of the earth and in the universe. As it is simple enough not to be open to any misinterpretation and needs no headman to translate, elaborate, or misuse the information for anyone else. Everyone will take from this letter according to their understanding of how to serve humanity and the universal community. To achieve peace, one has to find the essential causes of conflicts, then go to further, one has to eradicate the roots of the problems so that these conflicts never occur again. An outlasting peace in the mind, the home, the city, the nation, the planet, and in the universe can be maintained. In this letter, as the founder of the Keshe Foundation, secondly as a human being, and thirdly as a messenger of peace in these times, I see it as my personal responsibility to reveal the untold truth so that through it we can find the main causes of most of the wars in past centuries on this planet. With understanding the causes and the roots of the problems, mankind as a family and collectively as a race moves into a new phase of peace and prosperity. Let us call this day a new day and a new era for the race of man, and make this entry under the title of a new destiny for mankind. What does this mean today, as on this day of 28 February 2013, the religious leader of one manner of worshiping the Creator, known as the Catholic Church, as a sect of Christianity, and its head known as the Pope, is resigning. And with this act, he is opening the path for the election of a new pope. Some men hope that the new pope will bring a new hope of peace, not as the wish for one part of the human community, but as a reality for all people on this planet. To start with a clean slate and work towards world peace and a world peace treaty, one has to put on the table all the present and past facts that have caused or instigated wars, and then sincerely do something about them so no conflict can take root in the race of man ever again to lead to war or to give anyone the opportunity to use these to start and incite wars for the future. Otherwise, the same misguided acts will repeat themselves, and the same wars and conflicts will take hold in the future in different sections of society. The aim of the new era is to establish the establishment of everlasting peace and abolition of the causes of war, of the production of tools of war, to support these divisions and the claims to superiority of one race or school of thought or belief over another. As one eradicates the causes of war, then one finds that there is no need to make the tools of war. And in peacetime, the energy and the intellect of man can be utilized to serve others and to add to his total knowledge and understanding himself, his environment, the creation, and the creator. I would like to outline what has been wrong and what has to be corrected and what needs to be done so that the mistakes of the past will not repeat themselves in the future. There will never be among the race of man any ground to start a war on this planet or in the universe. First of all, let's be open and clean the house of the human family and understand the roots of number of past and current wars on this planet among different races, where all races of the men originate from the same mother. One of the root causes of war on the planet for at least the past 1,000 years has been the use of the name of God and the word religion. Wars have been, and even today are, incited and fought for domination of one sort of religion over another, and in the attempt by the leaders of these so-called religions of God to find out which religion has more followers, so that through greater numbers one religion can collect more money, assets, and power through their various offices under the name of synagogues, mosques, churches, temples, and so forth. In the fact, the best organized system among these with one central office has been Christianity, as Islam and Judaism have never achieved centralization through their own fault of division and infighting. Thus, the name of God has been and is used to create division among men to gain more money and prestige for those who call themselves priests, imams, rabbis, and so forth, to satisfy their insignificant self-wishes and desires under the pretense of the holy name of God. To have peace on earth, there is a need to unify man's approach to this path of belief in the holy name of any house of worship. What does this mean? This means that from now on, one worships his own soul as he worships his so-called God or the Creator under different names and banners. One's soul is itself connected to and part of the soul of the Creator and the soul of other fellow beings on this planet and in the universe. The soul of man is created through division of the same original source and through the accumulation and integration of the same fields, which had been, are, and shall be in motion in different strengths and positions in the universe. From the beginning of time, this process has led to the creation of different beings in different parts and times in the universe, and neither the process nor time itself shall ever end. This act of worship of one's own souls will bring about the result that man will do harm to himself, and through it he will not harm others. Through this manner of living and thinking correctly about one's conduct, one avoids all problems for oneself and one's fellow creatures across the planet and the universe. The commandment, "Thou shalt not steal," does not only mean physically stealing material things from another man's pocket. It also means robbing from a soul that which it needs to elevate itself to higher levels of perfection in all the realms of creation. Then, when one steals from another, this act causes the loss of the soul of the victim too. Thus, the effect is two things, one physical and one for the soul of the victim. However, the soul is aware of the misconduct of its physical part, and in turn, the soul's interactions will punish the physical body, even the unseen crimes that are done in secret, as there is nothing hidden from the detached and perfect soul. Then let us see how the name of the Creator has been used to harm so many people over the centuries in order for some few to attain and maintain privileged lives in the false name of God. To maintain their position, they get involved and they commit theft from other souls who are on the path of serving God, Allah, or any other name that man has chosen to call the original source of existence or the Creator. It is interesting that in different mother tongues, the liquid of life man needs to exist has been called water, aqua, abhi, etc. And these different sounds that man has chosen to name the same entity do not change the essential life-giving attributes of this substance. Then why should the name of the Creator of water be different when in essence, it gives life to the body and soul of man? In recent years, in my banishment, exile, and imprisonment, in different forms, in different parts of the world, and by different nations and leaders, and countries and religions, I became aware of one point, which is that the leaders of the world, whether religious or political, are not afraid of my knowledge, but are afraid of what my knowledge will do to their time in bring their misconduct into the open and make them ashamed of what they have done wrongly to others in the false name of religion and nations. Let me explain why I titled this part of this letter, New Pope, New Hope. Why this title? The answer to this is very simple. Since this name and title of Pope is a reminder of how the name of the Creator has been used for centuries through the office of different religions, not only to gather wealth, but to protect the abusers in this house under the name of the Creator. The house of God has become the sanctuary for those who have been harming their fellow men with their misconduct. However, this house, or others like it, may be named, and however their abuse of the name of the Creator might be named, or described. Today, 28 February 2013, one of these wrongdoers of men is resigning under the cover of being unable to perform his duty as the leader of one of the houses of worship. But what is the truth about the sudden, unprecedented resignation of the Pope? Let us open the book of current world affairs, not for the leaders of the world, but for humanity, and then we will look at the wrongs of the past later on in this letter. The current Pope, who is resigning today, has been associated with a number of wrongdoings, mainly through the same supposed men of God who he has been in league with to rob and steal from the souls of others with their misconduct, and this should not be so. Let me explain. The current Pope had to resign due to several facts which had been hidden from the public. First, his name is directly associated with a number of individual and collective pedophilia cases in the USA, Canada, and Ireland. These indictments for arrest and conviction are in clear evidence in the cases of priests who have been arrested and imprisoned by the authorities in different parts of the world and accused by the followers of these false men of God of being involved in inhumane treatment and abuse of boys and girls who were under their protection for the development of their souls. The other point, which is not known to the public, is that the popes have used all the money and the wealth that has been collected in past centuries in the name of God, under the protection of priests in the house of God, to wage open and hidden wars on other religions and creeds, through encouraging and financing and waging wars using different nations over which they have influence in order to keep the financial dominance of one religion over others. Taking as an example, the war in the Middle East between Jews and Muslims in recent past, these continuous wars have been and are creating division between two religions that have lived peacefully for centuries alongside and among each other. The Catholic Church has financed and incited wars so that during the fighting among two of its competitors, the house of worship of the popes can show itself at the eye of the weak and common man as better than the other two, and thus can gather more followers and consequently more income from those new followers. These new followers will think that the house of the Pope is the best of the three, and thus it can accumulate more wealth and power. Through inciting conflict and financing these false wars using religion among the creatures of the Creator on this planet. At the same time, one can see how the same church has created a peaceful environment in the European community, which the ex-president of France said was a Christian organization. Thus, if the Vatican can bring peace to its followers in Europe, why does it not use the same effort to bring peace to the rest of humanity, if the name of God is to be used in the right way? Why should the European community of Christians be the cause of war between Muslims and Christians and Jews in other continents, by the European nations being the biggest producer of war machines and tools of war? This pattern of behavior and conduct has been used by the same house as it has accumulated more followers and wealth in Africa and South America and Central Asia, where wars between religions initiated in the so-called name of achieving peace and the name of God have been financed by our religious money from Vatican under the banner and use of the USA, UK, and other nations of the same belief. At the same time, this superiority of world power through the Vatican and Christianity has been used in the context of nuclear technology in the recent past too, where, except for China and non-Christian India, the rest of the Christian nuclear powers nations have used their self-given rights of veto and false United Nations structure to stop any Islamic nation from attaining nuclear power. And they have made it to be the biggest crime if anyone except a Christian nation develops nuclear technology. This is done in order to keep the exclusivity of nuclear power in the hands of the Vatican and its operating nations. And any attempt by any non-religious and non-Christian nation like Iran is declared to be a threat of world peace. But in fact, it is the threat to the power of the so-called office of the Pope. It is only threatening to equalize the balance of power if Iran and other nations achieve nuclear power technology. Why do these Christian and nuclear club nations not use the same scientists and expertise to make the tools of peace and promote peaceful activity? Why did a British government figure traveling with a full team of several hundred military and arms experts recently to make a special trip just to sell the tools of war to another nation in Middle East only to benefit the British workforce and no one else, while promoting itself as a peace-loving nation? Why should a man ever touch these tools made by another man's effort that can end the life of another being, be it of man on earth or other creatures of God in the universe? Why has arms manufacturing become the fashionable exclusivity of mainly Christian nations when it has been said clearly, "Thou shalt not kill"? Christians make tools of war and encourage others to use them to kill others so that in turn they can create profit for their nations out of the loss of life of others. This is another type of murder and against the rules of God. Why did the new Pope and other religious leaders of earth not organize a religious peace conference and enforce peace as one of the only religious obligations? Interestingly enough, why have European nations taken the borders out of Europe in the past 20 years so there is no need for large armies and they are dismantling their armies? And meanwhile, these nations encourage the sale of arms to others by promoting the protection of their borders. In fact, there should be no borders, and the new technology we have released guarantees the abolition of borders. National security has to be in the hands of the nation's police force, and the name of the army has to be erased from man's vocabulary and language. The word army has to be buried in the grave of history, along with the violent men of the past. The word army has to be deleted from the tools of peace, and arms manufacturing has to be abolished and be a punishable offense under every law in every land on earth and beyond. One of the facts, not commonly known, is that under the banner of a peaceful nation, Switzerland was the biggest supplier of tools of war to the German army in the Second World War. This so-called peaceful nation is the biggest arms manufacturer and supplier of the most horrendous war weapons that man has ever seen on this planet. And the Red Cross on its flag is the true color of the blood this nation has adorned itself with from the deaths it has caused by supplying arms to kill others in that war. The behavior of this pretend peaceful nation brings shame to its name and embarrassment to the world, to the word peace. These acts of deception and manufacturing and creating tools of war and causing war among men of the same planet and in the universe have to come to an end. This dishonest production of arms has to be stopped and replaced with peaceful activities at once and not over a period of time. In any case, the new technology we have released has made the present nuclear technology and most advanced man-made technology of war obsolete. And if nations would like to see the power of this technology, we are ready to display its power for total annihilation of all the arms that man has made over the centuries. We will allow the nations that have the USB stick to show how amateur the current and the most advanced weapons technologies and defense technologies of the West have become compared to the new spaceship program, space defense technology developed for protecting man in space from its natural hazards. This power has to be shown several times. This power has been shown several times in the past 2 years by governments that are peaceful by capturing the most advanced aircraft from the sky, like a falcon catching a fly in mid-flight. With this new technology and by the use of one system alone, all borders, land, and sea connections of any nation can be closed in order to keep out any shipping or air supply or land cargo of arms. The economy of a country like the UK or USA can be brought to a full standstill of exporting or importing if one unit of the new technology is used to fly over the borders of these nations, as one can electronically disable all engines and communication modes of any ship in the sea, aircraft in air, and cars on land, respectively. Let's think and talk peace and act peacefully, and let the religious and political leaders of the world use their power and position to make arms manufacturing the most heinous crime that man can participate in, if they are true men and followers of the true God. Killing is forbidden in all religions, and from now on, the man who manufactures the tools for killing another man under the banner of war, defense, and retaliation has to be the most sinful man that ever existed. Let us see who would like to be sent to the darkest points of the universe for thinking, designing, manufacturing, and using weapons of war to kill another man. In reality, there should be no nuclear weapon technology in the hand of any nation or religion or its agencies under the banner of one nation or the human race. How come that all the bad guys are Muslims and Jews, while other followers of God in the name of Christian nations are the saviors by selling arms to them to kill each other and staining their chosen tradition of worshiping the Creator? Why should a nation pride itself on having the biggest financial income from the sale of arms and be in competition to see who sells more arms to those who do not need them? Once the tools of war are made, they have to be used, and this leads to more death and suffering, more damage to the souls of others. In fact, the nations producing weapons have to incite more wars so that they can keep up their factories and employment. So arms manufacturing needs wars to feed and keep it going, and this in turn brings more suffering to the one who uses them by killing someone's child or someone's father. From now on, the instigators of war and producers of the tools of war bear part of the punishment for the killing, and the same punishment in the eye of the Creator as the man who pulled the trigger to kill another man and disturb his soul. From now on, the instigators of wars and producers of tools of war bear part of the punishment for the killing. That was accidentally written twice. Thus, the crime of the manufacturers carries the same punishment as the crime of the one who pulls the trigger. Similarly, the punishment for the man who pulls the trigger to kill a man or his child is the same as the whole nation of manufacturing the arms and the tool which the killing is done with, because the income from selling the weapons goes to benefit that nation and its citizens. Shame on the man, the organization, and the nation that thinks, benefits, manufactures, and pulls the trigger to kill another being. Then let there be no more war, because one day the same intentions of killing others may cause an attack on the nation that produced the arms to start with. Now that man has been warned of his wrongdoing in inciting conflict and manufacturing the tools of war, those children and beneficiaries who inherit the physical wealth created by these wrong actions shall also inherit the punishment of their father's wrongdoing. If the men of greed wish to leave a good name for their bloodline, they should consider that the same glory and the same shame will be inherited by their offspring and their souls. So let us see who would like to put his dearest into the same turmoil of everlasting peace of their soul in all the realms of creation through their physical thoughts and actions during their time of physicality on this planet. Man needs to live, think, and conduct himself correctly from birth to the physical grave, and has to teach himself correct behavior, not only so that he himself does not fall for everlasting into the lowest levels of creation, but to make sure that the same shall not befall his fathers and his offspring. Then there shall be no soul harmed or deprived by the wrongdoings of others for its natural progression to reach the highest levels to meet its Creator, and at the same time, as no one stirs up conflict, no one needs to create tools of war to harm others. From now on, pride will come from being a true servant to all creation, and not from being the biggest arms manufacturer in the world. Similarly, those whose money is used to finance the shares of arms manufacturing companies and defense technology will sit on the same seat as the man who pulls the trigger to kill. Silence the shareholders benefit from the company sales and dividends that they invested in their income, whether through pension funds or as individuals. Walking away from war has to become the habit of man, not for the fear of punishment, but out of pleasure in being able to elevate one's soul and others to higher levels of receiving the blessing of their soul. Let this be a lesson for those who try to justify inciting war and making the tools of war. Then again, why does the Vatican not use its influence for bringing peace by being and inciting peace in according with the thoughts, the actions, and work of the blessed Christ, the peace of God beyond his soul? In the eyes of the 80% of Earth's population who are not followers of Christ, Christians are mainly involved in arms manufacturing and promoting their sale. Hence, Christians under the banner of whichever sect are known as the merchants of death. This is exactly opposite to why the Christ, blessed be his name, gave and sacrificed his life. It is the responsibility of the new Pope to change the operation of the Christian community in being the merchants of death. If he is to fulfill the wish of the prophet, the Christ, most holy be his name. Thus, the title of New Pope, New Hope. I do not need to write about the abuse of the name of Muhammad, God's peace beyond his soul, as this has been well recorded in the pages of history in the past centuries. Even his name is used to incite more killing, as if it is man's right to kill in his name. Where he only brought about the destruction of statues so that man would worship only one creator. Then the man of greed and power used this thought of destroying statues to kill other men. Muhammad, peace be on his soul, has said that the punishment of thief is the amputation of his finger and hand. Then what is the punishment for killing another man in the name of the same prophet? Nowadays, killing in his name has become rewarded by a plastic key to the gates of heaven, and this is the gate of which God? The God that has promoted peace and unity. The God that has given the life of a son to bring peace to this animal nature of man, who looks for different ways to prove it and emphasize his personal ego in the name of himself, his nation, and his religion, though in fact he serves no other man and God but himself. Now it is Muslims who are always the wrongdoers. Before it was the Jews, and before that it was the communists, and so on. So in fact, the wars of the past centuries and the recent past have been because of religious wanting superiority and gathering more wealth through donations from people who thought that their contributions every day of the week and the year were to be used for the good of the fellow men and for bringing peace to them. But in fact, their contribution has brought more weapons and financed more wars than any other source on this planet. The fact is that the message of New Pope, New Hope is applicable not only to the followers of God in the name of Christianity. This should be the same behavior with all religions and sects and their leaders on this planet. In actual fact, there is no money left in the vaults of the Vatican Bank, and again only through an act of the same Pope who has resigned under suspicious circumstances. When the German Cardinal became Pope 7 years ago, in one of his first acts, he made himself the head of the Vatican Bank and immediately transferred all the reserves of the second biggest bank in the world to the Central Bank of Germany, as the same central bank transfers to Germany were done by the so-called European Union Treaty as a precondition to start off the euro as a currency. But this time the Vatican money was used to support the losses of the Western Christian governments that have lost everything in recent years through the market and bank failures. This was done to preserve the superiority of the so-called Christian European governments in the present financial troubles in Europe and the USA. The initial reason for the transfer of the Vatican's wealth to the Central Bank of Germany in the first days of the new Pope coming into power was to avoid paying the large claims in the court cases in the United States and Ireland and around the world for the priests who have abused children. So when the international court claims were served on the Vatican to pay these heavy penalties for the wrongdoing of its priests, there were no physical funds left to pay them. Because of the deception, the money was already gone out of the bank and it never came back, and now it is totally lost in supporting other wars and governments and its and their financial failures in the banking systems. In fact, the only assets left for the Vatican on paper are nothing more than a few lands that have not been already borrowed on to the hilt to run the affairs of the broken systems. But in reality, the finance of the church is hidden under the banner of the biggest war to come. Thus, new and extensive wars are needed to create more followers and wealth for the new Pope to maintain his power. By our consent, this war shall not be allowed to happen. And if they start it, then there will be an end to the love of God for this sector of men. As Muhammad, holy be his name, banished the Jews for their crime against Christ, blessed be his soul, then there shall be a worse punishment for the Christians if they wage another war or incite war as they have done, as we explained above. It took the Jews centuries to regain their freedom, and this time there shall be none if the path of war is chosen by any nation and religion, be it Christian, Muslim, Jew, communist, or any other way of worshiping oneself in materialist separation of school of thought. Thus, the Pope's resignation announced in February is a protection-building procedure so that no one can be blamed. This man has taken refuge in another house of God, and according to him, he will not see anyone and will not talk to anyone anymore. So supposedly he cannot be asked about the truth. My call is simple: for a fair, equal, and lasting peace among men of the planet. If an African president could be taken from the seat of presidency to the International Court Tribunal in the Netherlands for trial for crimes against humanity, and using children and using child soldiers for killing and raping and looting, the crime of man in the robe of God is more heinous than that of his president. Thus, the man has to be investigated who has committed a crime when he is trusted by people leaving their children and finances in his hands and those of his priests, and he has to be punished in the same court and be judged by other followers of other ways of worship in the world and not be judged by his own followers in these courts. The Hague should not become the court of the white skin for shaming the followers of other religions and races. It has to take action against all men of wrongdoing in every realm of power, be it political, military, or religious. Put the man on trial, like the African president and the Central European leaders of the late 90s who were sent to the same international court. And if all evidence clears him, then let him be set free. Otherwise, shackle this man to the walls of the prison until the last breath and erase his name from the list of popes after the true men of service like John Paul, the last real pope 7 years ago, who served man in the name of God. The problem is that the atrocities committed in the name of religion have given strength to the abusers and followers of the religions too. As they see the leaders of their so-called belief doing wrong and getting away with all wrongdoing, so they follow the same misconduct thinking that they will never be caught. This means that there are leaders and kings who have done wrong and have had their religion and religious apparatus to protect them. These leaders and kings, under cover of political or diplomatic protection, have to be subjected to the same laws as everyone else. This means that if they have the duty to protect their nationals, and in this process they have abused their position by killing, raping boys or girls, killing children for their personal ego and sexual pleasures, as some have done and are still doing, these leaders and kings have to stand in the court of The Hague immediately so that they do not even get a chance to escape or commit false suicide. These leaders and kings have to be put on trial in The Hague and treated like other men, and if they are found to be committed to have committed these crimes, then they should be punished more harshly than normal people in the street. If the father of a family kills or rapes the children for whom he is responsible, nowadays and in the past, such a father has been beheaded or imprisoned. So it should be no different for the father of a church, mosque, or synagogue, a president, or king or queen, who abuses their position to harm the body or the soul of a child or another fellow creature. Let me explain a few of these cases. One of the reasons why the Keshi Foundation has been under such pressure in Belgium has not been so much from the political sector, but from those who use the political apparatus to enrich themselves and to fill their pockets. But these people have had the protection of a man who is the most criminal man on earth. There are more than 50 cases of child abuse and killing of children in international courts in his personal name. But he is protected by the Vatican and at the same time shunned by other royal families of Europe for his conduct. He has not been seen at any royal functions in Europe for years, and the people who have protected him are using his weakness to fill their pockets with their wealth of their nation. I do not mention his name, as writing it would bring shame to my pen of truth. But if you want to know him and his cronies, please read the Belgian press between 15 to 18 January of 2012, and full pictures and full 4 pages of it. He has been to public functions only twice in the whole of 2011, and as the other members of the European royal families and political leaders of the West are aware of his conduct of rape and killing and keep themselves and their children away from his presence. In fact, what I have written earlier is not far from reality for the Jewish tribe too, who should have learned from their suffering of the centuries, and especially in the last century, in being given a land to call home. Instead of making a home with friends in Palestine, They chose the name of God to create more wars and killing among their neighboring countries. Our hope was that they would have learned what it meant to be banished from home and have your life savings confiscated, as was done to them in the Second World War. We thought that this would have shown them to be correct, to not do what you do not like to be done to you. But on the contrary, we have seen nothing but the worst done by this tribe to others, to neighboring countries, as was done to them in the last centuries. Thus again, those who use the name of God do so to cause more suffering for their own benefit, as has been said. We have seen these too openly in the news of past, and it is too shameful to repeat the atrocity using the holy name of Muhammad and his teachings, just as has been done by the followers of Moses and Christ. The same can be said about the followers of Muhammad, blessed be his name. Those who have used his name and teachings for their own financial gain in killing and looting other believers' property and lives under the holy name of Allah. We have seen these two openly in the news of the past years, and too ashamed to repeat the atrocity using the holy name of Muhammad and his teachings, the same as has been done by followers of Moses and Christ. One faith is not lesser than the other in inflicting suffering on their own followers and others. Abuse by man of his fellow men has been the same over the centuries under different names and banners, and all have brought suffering to the physical body of man, but not to his soul. The soul of man is born pure and everlasting. It needs no ties and no affiliation to the Creator, as it is part of the Creator and the created, the link between the tangible and the extra-dimensional. It exists in eternal tranquility, abundance, enlightenment, and peace. Finding the everlasting peace is only attainable for man in a single way and manner, and that is by the name of Creator becoming the focus of unity of the race and not of the division of souls. The opportunity for peace, as it is in the hand now, has not arisen by chance. It marks the moment when the intelligence of the majority of this planet's inhabitants has reached a level where they can not only support themselves, but can assist, aid, and give time to teaching their fellow men to reach a new level of collective comprehension of the totality of the world of existence and not be limited to the life of a hermit race of man on this beautiful island of Earth in the ocean of the joyful life of the universe. Service to mankind and others comes from and with the comfort of thoughts and peace for the body and the soul, and now that we have opened the gates of the universal knowledge to man, it is time for man to take the leap of trust in his soul, the Creator and himself, and to release himself from the shackles of materialistic life, which is not worth it and does not last. The call to the sons of Adam is simple. Gather in unison and take the flight of reunion in the realms of creation, as this time is destined, not by your choice, but your divine grace, to release you from the pains of self-inflicted earthly bondage. The ones who call yourselves rulers and kings and religious peers, you have lost your seats unless you have taken the seat to serve the good of man as has been promised. The time has come when you, the wrongdoers and misusers of the trust of man, shall face your destiny and there shall be no mercy, whatever you have thought of your actions. You know within yourselves and in time your own souls shall bring you to the level where you deserve to exist in the realm of creation. Thus, from now on, there shall not be punishment by man or God, but self-regulation of one's greed and desires, which will allow service and creation of peace for all creations of God in all realms of creation and all dimensions of the universe. The time of fire and hell is over, but the time of fear of one's self not reaching the ultimate unity of souls and the Creator is the new earth order, and in fact is the universal law of existence. Blessed are those who understand the hand of knowledge and the oceans of abundance of the food of the soul, and are not afraid of the unknown, as the unknown is part of one's own fear of being just and fair to himself and others, in the realms of physicality or of intangibility. My call is simple to the men of power and to the destitute alike. Assist each other so that in unified physicality you reach the unification of your souls. And thus, as one flower, you can ascend to new levels of understanding the truth about yourself, your unified soul, and the creator of the universe and universal cosmos. Man has spent enough time fighting for water, for pleasure, for blocks of dust of the earth, and for position, status, and wealth, which are nothing but the dust of this smallest of all planets and speck of dust of the universe called home. Unify in serving each other, and through this you shall find the key to the mysteries of creation and open the door that has kept you away from reunion with others of the same and the realms of the soul and the intangible. My call from my physical form and the new paradise of freedom is simple: to free you from the bondage of physicality, and you shall find peace in serving the souls of others. My call to the new Pope, Islamic religious leaders, Jewish rabbis and other leaders of faith, tradition and world leaders is simple. Please sign your faith and your followers and your nations, not on paper, but in action and deeds for everlasting world peace and the World Peace Treaty. And in turn, we shall open the door of abundance, peace and tranquility to your followers as we shall do and have done to others, to other men and creatures of the universe. This same call goes to the other leaders of religions and beliefs and paths of enlightenment on earth. Put aside your hierarchy of golden palaces and temples, which in the name of the Creator serves the Creator of the shadows of nothing. Ask your flocks to think the same way and in the same manner, to serve and not to look for returns and payment, as the service will bring the souls to assist the physicality to find peace and through it to free man from the physical shackles of needs to satisfy his self-love and self-satisfaction and self-gratification. I am servant to all in the all, dimensions of creation, and not only to man, and in truth, the true believers of service in all realms of creation shall understand the position and height of closeness I have offered this tribe of man to reach, if he decides to unify the serving his fellow man and others in the universe. Let us take an example of a land and the maturity of its people. Iran used to be an empire, and through that it learned that war is not the solution for its subjects. Thus the Iranians have stayed away from the war machine for over 300 years. But they have defended their fellow countrymen with collective unity, even though they belong to many tribes and cultures. Now it is time to take the example of Iran and Iranians and bring the same to the human race. The other causes of conflicts in the past and present time. The other main cause of the wars on this planet has been pride in one's color of skin, tribe, and race. The false thinking that one race is better than the other just because of the color of their skin has been used to enforce their so-called superiority, which has caused long-term resentment and conflicts in the race of man. In reality, all men have come from one mother and one seed, and all have dispersed to secure their existence in the environment of Earth according to where they live. Being black and moving from the warmth of Africa has made man's skin change color to white as he has moved away from the equator. This change of color has not made any difference to his internal organs and way of operating his physicality. As with the earlier example of water and religion, why should the color of skin or the language be the cause of prejudice and hate and wars and conflict? The whole of the human race is from one source, and in future we shall show the process of its creation from the essence and origin. We as a race are from one seed and one mother. So what is the point of this racism unless one is ignorant and one's own creation and not proud to be a human? People in the West and around the world go and buy different flowers to adorn their homes and bouquets of different colors, shapes, and scents, and these beauties of the earth So how come they do not see the beauty in the variation and culture of their own race? Shame, shame, and shame to those most feeble in mind who manifest this prejudice of race. Let these prejudices go as soon as you will cling to the smallest signs of man in the vast ocean of creeds and races of the universe with their most beautiful source and shapes and colors. Be proud to be from the race of man and be known not for separation and division, but as the ones who know how to love and adore each other and all of the universe's creation. A further point to clarify. It has been raised in private and in public and on the forum of the foundation. If I am the prophet or a promised one, and if my peace treaty document about the status of scientists makes me a prophet, my answer to these questions, which have been raised among my family and my close friends for years, and now public, is very simple. The answer clearly and irrevocably is yes. I am a messenger and a messenger of science through its power and a messenger of peace. In the passage of the time, the prophets of the past appeared at a time when the human race needed to attain a new understanding of what was to come. Their holinesses, Muhammad, Christ, Moses, and the rest all appointed the time of the return of the Promised One as the time of peace and milk and honey. In fact, the time of the prophets of earth had come to its end long before the time when I declared my position. As the prophets they promised, they have been prophets for the race of man. And his time on earth, which was fulfilled long before this time in the last century. My job and mission is guiding and teaching man so that he can finally join the rest of creation of the Creator in the universe. Our jobs as prophet of the man and messengers of universe are clearly separate and have different criteria and objectives. The prophets of man never spoke of the reunion of man with the universal community, as this was not their appointed duty. Even though they were aware of the existence of both dimensions, man at their time was not ready for such a transformation and knowledge. Now that man is ready, it is our clear job and duty as the universal messengers with full knowledge of the working of the universe and its society to guide man through this narrow channel full of opportunities for things to go wrong. One being is opening of the universe to man, and the other is guiding the man with the interaction of man with the universal community. It is our job as universal messengers to prepare man for the unification in an orderly and correct manner, even though not all men will understand this initial stage. For this reason, we have started to correct the mistakes of science in the books released initially, and now we are ready to take you through to the universal community. But the universe is a peaceful place, and there is no room for aggression and war. So the nations of Earth have to find peace among themselves and then enter the universal community as mature people. This is the responsibility that I have accepted in my soul. My physical body has no importance to me, as my wish and thoughts shall be carried through. Peace on Earth shall become a reality in a short time. And if need be, we have the knowledge and the power to enforce it if the world leaders and religions would like to see the power of our will. Those who would like to see, to believe, have to stand the pain of its power too. The prophet of man is for the guidance of earthly beings and earthly knowledge. But as the duty of a universal prophet, my job is the unification of all the races in the universe. As universal prophets, we are more informed about the total structure of the working of the universe and universal coexistence. And as guardians, it is our job to see that all creatures of the Creator are served and reach the same level of understanding of their creation and science, so that one race cannot abuse another due to its lack of knowledge. Thus, as I have started the true basic teaching of the correct science, in due course, and already I have started teaching of the soul and of the correct conduct of man in the universal community as we prepare man for this imminent event when he takes wing into space beyond Earth and in the universe with the rest of the universal community. Some of the men who have been open to this message have already understood and started to behave correctly so that in the future their conduct in the universe will be appropriate. The promised day of judgment is a matter of one's daily behavior and the consequence of the balance of the souls who are affected by the conduct of the physicality. In the earthly religions of the past, the day of judgment was seen to be the ultimate time, and in truth, the time of departure and separation of the soul from its body, or the time of physical death, where in reality, the only point left for the soul at the time of death is to find its position according to the physical behavior of its counterbody and the time of the physical life in the realms of other entities in the universe. So the man who has conducted himself correctly and received more of the blessing or parts of the soul of others will have a higher position and stronger fields that enable his soul to interact with the higher level and more effective souls that serve in the rest of the universal community. In the act of giving one's blessing, this is the act of giving a part of one's own existence, as blessing comes from thoughts, and thoughts are energy-based. Thus there shall be no hell and no heaven, but a clear station where one's soul will be positioned and operate in the universal order. That is why we say, pray for our parents up on their passing to guide their souls to higher elevation than when they were here on earth, as the existence of the soul has no time and dimension, and their soul still can receive part of our soul through our prayers. This is like the birth of a child from a mother, where the child born to a mother in the slums will live with the same, and the child born in a palace will live in a similar community with nobles and physical life. To go from one society to another is still possible in the realms of the soul, as one can attain enough through receiving blessing from others, from serving humanity, so that at the time of passing, the soul of the man in the slum can and will attain a higher position than the sum of the souls of all princes and kings in the sinful palaces of the kingdoms. Thus, my mission is clear, and that is not to create division among men, as they have done enough of that by themselves, but to make ready and create the conditions where man can soon rejoin the universal community for the final time in an orderly and correct manner with correct conduct and behavior and knowledge. Blessed are those souls who understand, comprehend, and become part of the peaceful universal community, for the creation of greater peace in the universe and not a lesser peace only on this planet, has ever been and ever shall be. Meran Tavakoli Keshi. Original written in February and finalized 23 March 2013. Everybody, I would like to continue past our usual time. I would like to go another hour on this program, if you're willing to stick with me here. The reason why is because on April 29th to May 3rd, we will have the citizens' hearing in Washington, D.C. And today, I would like to be focused on one of the witnesses to the hearing, who is Apollo astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And I'd like to give you an introduction to him now. Before I do that, I want to briefly give you some updates about the citizens' hearing. This is coming from the front page of citizenhearing.org. I'd like to read this to you. An event with historical implications will be held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. from April 29th to May 3rd, 2013, At that time, as many as 40 researchers and military agency witnesses will testify for 30 hours over 5 days before former members of the United States Congress. Note, the full citizen hearing will be webcast live on the internet. And I encourage everyone to subscribe to that. It's $3.80 for the entire week. Go to citizenhearing.org to get your access. The link will be emailed to you, and you can click on that link anytime during the week, during the day or evening sessions, and you will be able to see everything that's happening. And I am begging everybody to be witness to the Citizens Hearing live or live stream. The Citizens Hearing Committee will be Senator Mike Grable, Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, Congresswoman Carolyn Kilpatrick, Congresswoman Darlene Hooley, Congressman Roscoe Bartlett, and Merrill Cook. An event with historical implications will be held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. from April 29th to May 3rd. The Citizens Hearing on Disclosure of an Extraterrestrial Presence Engaging the Human Race will attempt to accomplish what Congress has failed to do for 45 years. Seek out the facts surrounding the most important issue of any other time. When M.T. Keshe speaks about the universal community, he's speaking about the extraterrestrial presence in our universe that we are interacting with. For this reason, the motto of the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure is, if the Congress will not do its job, the people will. Reflecting the global implications of this issue, the entire Citizens Hearing for Disclosure will be live streamed worldwide in English and Spanish and archived in Arabic, Hindi, Japanese, and Mandarin. This represents approximately one half of the world's population. The live webcast will also include side press conferences and witnesses, as well as interviews by former CNN news anchor Cheryl Jones. The English and Spanish webcast will include evening lectures presented by hearing witnesses. Access to these webcasts are available by subscription. That's $3.80 for the whole week, so there's no reason anyone shouldn't do that. The Citizens Hearing on Disclosure will be filmed as the basis for a forthcoming documentary, The Truth Embargo, by Just Cause Entertainment. The title of this film is fitting, as the goal of the Citizens' Hearing is nothing less than the end of the extraterrestrial truth embargo this year. The world's people have waited long enough. Over the coming weeks, the site will develop rapidly with new information added daily. Check back often for updates. Note, the new documentary, Sirius, which premieres in Los Angeles on April 22nd, will have its Washington, D.C. premiere on Monday, April 29th at 8 p.m. after the first day of the Citizens' Hearing at the National Press Club, 13th floor Northwest, Washington, D.C. The film is directed by Emmy Award-winning Amardeep Kalika and includes a great deal of witness testimony. Seating is first come, first seated. Admission is free. Rachel Maddow, one of the smartest people working in television news today, devoted a full segment of her April 12th MSNBC program to Paradigm Research Group's Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, the first PRG disclosure petition to the White House and the White House petition response. It is quite notable that, while indulging in the customary, almost required, tongue-in-cheek, this very savvy woman included in this segment every single key point PRG is trying to make about the truth embargo and the current government status on the issue. Thank you, Rachel. So as you all know, I personally will be in L.A., at the L.A. premiere of the Sirius movie on April 22nd, and I will also be at the Citizens Hearing all week, April 29th to May 3rd in Washington, D.C. And this is because I feel that these may be the largest events of our lifetime, and I know that Disclosure is coming this year, and I'm there to be a part of it and lend my energetic support. I'd like to introduce Dr. Edgar Mitchell now. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Captain of the U.S. Navy and NASA, retired. On January 31, 1971, Navy Captain Dr. Edgar Mitchell embarked on a journey into outer space that resulted in becoming the sixth man to walk on the moon. The Apollo 14 mission was NASA's third manned lunar landing. The historic journey ended safely 9 days later on February 9, 1971. It was an audacious time in the history of mankind. For Mitchell, however, it was the most extraordinary journey was yet to come. As he hurtled earthward through the abyss between the two worlds, Mitchell became engulfed by a profound sensation, a sense of universal connectedness. He intuitively sensed that his presence, that of his fellow astronauts, and that of the planet in the window were all part of a deliberate universal process that the glittering cosmos itself was in some way conscious. The experience was so overwhelming, Mitchell knew his life would never be the same. Scientist, test pilot, naval officer, astronaut, entrepreneur, author, and lecturer, Dr. Mitchell's extraordinary career personifies humankind's eternal thrust to widen its horizons as well as its inner soul. Dr. Mitchell has an amazing lifetime of different careers. And it would be easy enough to focus on his work as an astronaut and that important place in as a witness to us engaging with extraterrestrial presence in the universal community. However, what I'd like to present today is something a little bit different, because the science that Dr. Mitchell has brought to us since he was an astronaut is nothing short of mind-blowing, or to say it a different way, it will free your mind. Very few of you have encountered his teachings before on this topic, the quantum hologram and extrasensory perception. No one can present this the way he can. I hope you'll enjoy this.
And we will go until such time as either you're ready to quit or they throw us off the stage. I only have about 45 minutes worth of presentation material, but I hope I will generate enough controversy and enough questions in that period that we can enter into dialogue. I enjoy the dialogue, I enjoy interacting, and I think that we all benefit much better when we do it that way. Now, just to get in to this program a bit, the reason I changed things around, I see John Alexander sitting out there, and he made some remarks yesterday that I wanted to pick up on here, so we'll start with those. Let me get this slide going. And he put up his first one of his slides yesterday to talk about all the nasty things that people can say when they disagree with you, and why science has fought the things we're talking about for so long. And that was the title of his slide. And he also pointed out, said the nasty things said about him and about all of us. So, and the title of that slide was Ad Hominem. So if we move on to today, I can point out some of the things that have been said about me as a result of being interested in this area and being associated with this sort of thing. And one of the first things they used to say 30 years ago, he got lost in space. And the second thing is, well, he's just a space cadet. And then some of them, some of my colleagues who had worked with me for a while and still didn't quite know quite how to take me into how to take all of this stuff. Something strange happened out there, but he's too bright to argue with. But he sure has a lot of weird facts that he throws at you. Well, that one came along, and then when I came out with The Way of the Explorer here 5 years ago, Kirkus Reviews, although other people gave me good one, Kirkus Reviews said he's trying to reinvent the wheel. We're starting to talk about how does science and mystical experience fit together. But then the crowning put down of all, which I'm sure many of us have experienced, just another bunny hugger. So that fits a lot of us, I think. But what we're going to talk about tonight, one of the things I wanted to point out to you before we get going, vis-a-vis that last slide we had up of all the nasty things people say and try to reject the ideas we've been putting out. First of all, why would a nice guy like me would they say things like that about? And that's because something strange did happen in space. It was the opportunity to see the universe and see the world from a different perspective. They say travel broadens. Getting on a mountaintop broadens. It gives you a different point of view. Well, being able to look at Earth from an ET perspective was pretty wow. Let me tell you a little bit about it because it did get this whole thing started with me. It was the peak experience, the eureka experience, an epiphany that made me realize I had to change the way I was thinking. Now, remember, at that time, I was a qualified Navy test pilot. I'd been in the Navy almost 17 years at that time. Had a PhD from MIT on aeronautics and astronautics, and about as linear left-brain thinking as you could get. But also, in the few years before, I'd become interested in J.B. Ryan's work at Duke, and had been studying parapsychological literature. And with just a few weeks to go before the flights, some two physician friends of mine, and I had said, you know, it'd be awfully nice to find out if this telepathy stuff worked at 200,000 miles. So nobody had had that opportunity before. So we cooked up an ad hoc experiment, which most of you already know about, in order to test that out. However, that wasn't the high point. That was just another thing to do. But on the way home, after that was done, after the work on the lunar surface was done, which was wonderful to be an explorer and to go where humans have never been, to set foot on another planet, and then to come home after a successful mission. And the unexpected happened. Looking at Earth like this tiny little blue ball, looking about twice the size that a full moon looks when you look at it from here. Looking at the stars behind and being awestruck by all of this. I suddenly realized from my MIT training in star formation and galactic formation and so forth, the molecules of this body, the molecules of that spacecraft and my partners had been prototyped in an ancient generation of stars. Okay.
Jesse. Once you get into the rhythm of cooking with Schwan's home delivery, inspired meals become second nature. Visit Schwan's.com today and save $10 off your first order. Schwan's home delivery. Open your door to delicious.
of a sudden, those were my molecules we were talking about. And it wasn't an intellectual exercise. It was just suddenly damn deeply personal. And it was a feeling experience. It wasn't an intellectual experience. And I suddenly realized that in a way we in science didn't understand, the universe was intelligent, interconnected, and that our modeling of answering the question, who are we and how do we get here, was incomplete and flawed. And that from our cultural cosmologies, coming out of religion, they were archaic and flawed. And now as a spacefaring civilization, the beginnings of spacefaring civilization, we needed to have a new story about ourselves and a new answer to the question, who are we, how did we get here, where are we going? What was interesting was I was accompanied by an ecstasy, a wow, an aha, a eureka. And the question to my linear left brain scientific mind was, okay, what kind of a mind brain is this that causes looking at the universe or looking at the world from a different perspective have this sort of euphoric feeling? It wasn't until I got back, curious about this, left NASA a year or so later, because it was obvious I wouldn't fly again until the shuttle, and I didn't want to fly a dash for 10 years. So one of the first things I did was, with some meager funds, commissioned a research, and we started digging through the ancient mystical literature, because neurology and psychology had nothing to say about what was going on. But I needed to understand and thought maybe the mystical literature would help me understand something. And I discovered, in digging through the literature, that what had happened in space had a name in the ancient Sanskrit called the Salvakampa Samadhi experience, where you see things in their separateness, but you feel them in their connectedness, accompanied by euphoria. Wow. Found something new. Didn't know about. That was enough to start me on a 30 years task in founding the Institute of Noetic Sciences to have a mechanism by which we could address with new eyes and new science or new methodology the question of consciousness. What is it? How did it come to be? Why is it like it is? Because since for the last 400 years, since René Descartes with his famous pronouncement of the separation of mind and body, physicality and spirituality, science and the church have proceeded along their individual paths with a minimum of interaction, with a tacit agreement to stay out of each other's backyard. But quantum science, at the beginning of this century, has thrown those two backyards and torn down the fence between them. And we needed to start looking from a scientific perspective of what is the nature of consciousness and why are these experiences like they are. Anyhow, we spent 30 years, many of you out here have spent equally long, in some aspect of that study or another. Many of you already know that Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff and I go back to the early 70s. At SRI when we were working, Brendan O'Regan and working in the next office who later became the Institute of Noetic Sciences Research Director, and Willis Harmon was there at the same time. And we were doing the work with Uri Geller and all of us interested in these types of events. What I want to show you tonight is some work that I have been doing for the last few years, since the mid-90s, since The Way of the Explorer first came out, in quantum holography. And from my opinion, it is a powerful discovery, and I think you'll see why as we go through, that has the potential, which I believe will be realized over the next decade or so, as we dot all the I's, cross all the T's, and find how this discovery fits in to the picture that we've been trying to create. Now, I know some of the old-timers in here, 30 years ago, we were all over the map trying to propose theories and ideas. How does consciousness, remote viewing, parapsychology, how does all this fit? What's the science behind it? And we had all had our pet theories, and they were all like this. 30 years later, we circumscribed the problem. It's coming in together pretty well. Do we have good, solid answers? No. We think we have some pretty good ones. We think it's narrowing. We think we're getting a handle on it. We think we're making better sense than we ever have. But we have to remember that our models are never complete until they've been tested and the anomalies and the bugs fleshed out. And we try to see if there's anything trying to disprove our own theory. That's what good science is about, trying to falsify your own concepts to see if they can stand the test of time. So I'm going to present to you some work tonight called quantum holography, or the quantum hologram. Heart pertains to remote viewing, and then on beyond to a number of other interesting implications that come from this. Buckminster Fuller, and you know who Bucky Fuller is, he coined the phrase spaceship Earth back in the 60s, was credited with saying, we're the crew of spaceship Earth and we're in mutiny. So he recognized the problems back then. I was privileged at one time to give a series of Buckminster Fuller lectures after his death, and that was a high part, one of the high points of my life.
Your smile, like other precious things that start off white, it yellows over time. When it comes to your smile...
lectures series, my lecture career. But he's accredited with the saying, if you want to understand the human condition, you must first understand the universe. But from the mystical point of view, and any great mystic will say, if you want to understand the universe, you must first understand the self. And what I've learned is that they're both right. Because from all the modern evidence, we seem to live in a universe that is self-organizing, intelligent, creative learning, interactive, participatory, evolving. And now we recognize it's a quantum system. And a large part of what I'll be talking about tonight, thank you. A large part of what I'll be talking about tonight is the newly discovered quantum aspects of that evolving macroscopic system we call the universe. So, to really understand any of it, if we take those two paradoxical statements at face value, we really need to understand it all. And in order to understand it all, we must examine, theorize, critique, and validate each of the parts. And that, of course, is what science is supposed to do in its most idealized form. But we're all quite recognized that science has its politics, its detractors, its just human beings, after all, with the same motivations, failings, and faults as the rest of us. So science is no more a pure system than is politics. And sometimes I think it's even worse because it has its own brand of politics. But we want to talk about the quantum hologram. What is it not? Let's define what we're not going to talk about tonight. Put it not within this notion. It's not about a holographic universe. From all evidence, the universe is not a hologram. It's a very real material structure. And it's not about a new kind of subtle energy. Because subtle energy research is very powerful. But this relates to it in a very strong way. And it's not about much multidimensional theories. And I'll show you why or tell you why as we get on through here. But it is about information. It's about nature's basic information system, which we've only just discovered in the last few years and began to start to understand it. Now, Elizabeth Rauscher talked on some of the notions the other day, which I'm going to pull in here, and you will see them perhaps in a slightly different form, but we're converging on the same ideas. We're also asking the question, because information is the basis of how we know whatever it is we know. Think of it in this fashion. We think we know. The question is, how do we know anything? Well, the word that we use in modern parlance is information. Information is just patterns of energy. Whether it's those letters up there, whether it's the stars in the sky, and the names of the constellations that the ancients gave to them, they're patterns that we give meaning to. Information is just patterns of energy. And whether it's in molecular form or whether it's in the form of light and whether it's just those patterns upon the wall, those are patterns of energy to which we give meaning. And that's why we know anything at all, because we can process information. Intelligence, a fine definition of intelligence, is the ability to process, manage, utilize information. So it's a very general, basic, fundamental definition that I want us to keep in mind. What we're going to see here and what comes out of this, whereas in quantum physics in this century and classical physics for 300 years before, the fundamental notions of physics is about energy and matter. What these developments I'm talking to you about does is to elevate the concept of information to a par with energy in physics. Now, this isn't universally accepted, but when all of the ramifications of what we're going to talk about tonight are brought forth, examined, critiqued, peer-reviewed, and argued, I'm sure that we will now be thinking that information is as fundamental in physics as energy itself. Now, I have to stop a minute and give a caveat here on something. I'm talking to you about things tonight, many of which there are several new papers have been written just in the last several months as breaking developments have taken place. My colleagues and I, mostly in Europe, who have been working on these processes, have written at least a half a dozen or so papers over the last two or three years, which have been in peer-reviewed journals, and but mostly in Europe. Much of what I'm going to touch upon tonight is not yet in finalized form. It's been peer-reviewed, but it has not yet been printed. So I can only speak a little judiciously about some of the concepts until that is done, and the film that they're doing back there of this talk cannot be released for another year until we get all of the paper work done and protect the very people that are doing much of the very, very hard work. So I'm titillating and teasing you with some information tonight that can't really become fully official and fully explained and the math and the physics and the experimental evidence fully revealed until the papers are written.
If you have a business, you have a story. And of course, every story needs an audience. So,
however, that's the way it goes. Okay. Quantum holography, it does seem to provide a very powerful model to explain certain things you've already talked about. John Alexander pointed out about Sheldrake's morphogenetic field. Quantum hologram looks like it is the mechanism that provides the information that Sheldrake talked about. It looks like it is quite germane in understanding Buena Vista's water memory. And you can
talk about that a bit later. It certainly is germane in trying to understand why remote viewing telepathy works. We'd even create a good model for reincarnation with this notion. We've recently created a very viable learning cosmology for the organization of the universe using this model. And I'll point out to you near the end of this talk, we've come up with a new theory of perception, which has already been written up. That's quite different than the theory of a classical theory of perception. It also gives us very strong clues to PK. And we'll discuss that a little bit later as to why that is true. And perhaps it can help us really understand in a process, a feedback loop, of why consciousness itself works, how it works, how it came to be, and why it is like it is. So, what's quantum hologram? First of all, it's rooted in the absorption emission phenomenon. Let me explain what that is for those that don't know. And I know we have a few physicists in here and mathematicians that do understand, but in general, let's tell what it is. All matter at the molecular level emits and reabsorbs quanta of energy spontaneously. And we're kind of illustrating that. So that if you were to look at any bit of matter, whether that's chair, this podium, our bodies, whatever, physical matter is emitting at the molecular level quanta of energy and reabsorbing it. That's a well-known, accepted fact. It's been around since the beginning of quantum mechanics for 75 years. No real problem or question about that. But rooted in absorption emission, is derived from the standard quantum formalism of the Heisenberg-Lie group algebra. That's for the mathematicians, physicists in the room. Here is the kicker. The discovery a few years ago by Dr. Walter Schell and Ernst Benz in Germany, that those emissions are coherent and carry information. That's a wow. That's a wow. Very, very profound when you start to look further at what the meaning of all of that is. It has been validated in the laboratory initially with MRI tomography. All of you are familiar with MRI machines. Probably many of you have been on one. Schimpf turned out is an MRI expert working to improve MRI machines to get greater specificity, less invasiveness. In other words, to get a clearer picture from MRI machines. And he came up with the formalism of the quantum hologram and realized by working with the MRI machines, that's what he was dealing with, this thing called the quantum holography, and started working on it. My other colleague, Peter Marsher, I'll tell you this little story. Peter Marsher, who was at CERN, is now semi-retired in England, lecturing and writing and doing research, freelance mostly. He was a mathematical physicist at CERN, and he and Schimpf were working on computing machines, quantum computers, and they were using much of this advanced theory and structure. And Peter Marsher heard me lecture in 1995 at Cambridge University, St. John's College at Cambridge in England. Heard me lecture on the dyadic model, which I present in The Way of the Explorer. He said, I think we've onto something that kind of validates what you're saying. Can we talk? So we went to lunch together. And he explained to me, right, he'd heard me lecture on the dyadic model, which is an information energy model. And he said, I think we've discovered exactly what validates your model. And he started telling me about the quantum hologram. And after listening to him talk and thinking about it for a week or so, I wrote him back and I said, hey guys, how about knocking off the building better quantum computers? Let's go solve the problem of consciousness. I think you found a very key ingredient. And since it had been validated already in the tomography experiments and improvements, we already were a leg up. We didn't have to go devise new experiments to validate what we were talking about. We just had to find some more usage of it. So what we realized that we were talking about is nature's own version of holography. We created, 40 years ago almost, laser holography, classical laser holography. The reason this is called holography is it obeys many of the same rules that we have used and discovered in creating holograms with laser light, and with splitting a beam, putting it back together, and so forth. So many of the characteristics of a classical hologram are indigenous and a part of the way nature has structured itself, and we've just discovered it. And what are the properties?
At BookIt.com, we think booking travel should be fun. That's why BookIt.com is so
feasible quantum hologram that make it so exciting. Well, first of all, it operates by phase conjugate adaptive resonance. For everybody in this room, the last word is the important one, resonance. For mathematicians and physicists in the room, the first three words are important. Phase conjugate adaptive. We'll concentrate on the word adaptive for a moment. What that means is that to order to perceive the signal and utilize the information, you have to have an adaptive sensor. And I'll tell you how that works in a little while. But phase conjugate, just to kick on it for a minute, what is PCAR, phase conjugate adaptive resonance? It's simply a mathematical term describing how resonance takes place. And it's the same type of resonance in principle we talk about. If you pluck a violin string here, and a similarly tuned violin string across the room starts to resonate or move in harmony with the string. It's the same type of resonance. Now, resonance mathematically, in this sense, if you have a wave moving in this direction and an identical wave moving in this direction, you can describe those as a standing wave. In other words, it seems like nothing is moving, they're just standing there. So if I shake hands with you, who's shaking hands? No, we're both shaking hands, not one or the other. We're both shaking hands. And both are moving together. That's a standing wave, okay? Or if you take a jump rope and both of you are shaking it and holding it the same and you get a wave in there, that is a standing wave, would be two resonant phase conjugate waves moving against each other so that they appear as a standing wave. That is resonance. And this is just mathematical lingo to help us understand that. But anyhow, it's a very, very important term. The information we're talking about is carried in the phase relationships. Now, this has been a no-no for 75 years. Quantum physicists didn't think information was carried in the phase relationship, but we're going to show you that that's true. Let me give you a lighthouse, a metaphor. It's called the lighthouse metaphor to help understand this concept. Very important to all of us. If you're walking on the seashore at night and in a fog settled on the bay, but you see on the scintillating wave-covered bay out here, you see lights reflected from something in the distance that you can't see because of the fog. If the fog were to be lifted, you could see a lighthouse over there shimmering on the waves. But you can't see the lighthouse in the waves. You can just see scintillating light. In principle, if you knew all the waveforms, you could still the waves and see the image of the lighthouse reflected in the water if it were smooth like a mirror. While in principle,
do you still the waves? Well, if you knew the wave equations and how the waves interacted, because the interaction is their phase relationship, if you could still the waves, you could see it. In principle, can you do that? Well, the answer is yeah. All of the modern high-powered telescope that we use to look at the heavens use exactly that principle. They shoot a beam of laser light into the heavens, catch the reflections from the air, atmosphere molecules and waves in the that causes the light to scintillate. The reflections come back down, is corrected on a computer program, and lo and behold, it makes the light coming in from the atmosphere very clear. What they're doing is correcting the phase relationships and the wave equations of the motion in the air to get the light to be clear and not distracted and distorted by the atmosphere. That's exactly the principle we're talking about. And indeed, so the information, as in a classical hologram, which is carried in the wave front, the interference front of the waves, information is carried in a quantum hologram in a phase relationship. And it turns out that the brain can act as a phase gate in a similar way and decipher the information in the quantum hologram when you're in phase conjugate adaptive resonance with the source of the hologram. So, it operates by phase conjugate adaptive resonance. It carries the complete history of the physical object that emitted the hologram, the quanta. It's carried non-locally. Elizabeth Rauscher was hammering on the notion of non-locality. Quantum hologram is a non-local structure, which means that the information is carried out through the universe. It also has the property of distributedness, such that a little portion of the hologram has all the information. It goes non-locally. What is happening with the quantum hologram? It's the macro scale equivalent of the quantum correlation that physicists discovered 75 years ago with regard to subatomic particles. And Einstein and others dismissed as being spooky action at a distance. It was only put into a testable form in 1966 by John Bell at CERN Laboratory, only decisively tested in 1982 by Alan Aspect and a team of physicists in Paris, that indeed non-locality and spooky action at a distance.
One of the biggest scams in U.S. history involved conning people into believing that their money was being invested as
is really valid, real stuff. And it has now been used to teleport photons, tiny particles over 400 kilometers, and validated completely in the laboratory. And sorry, Dr. Einstein, you were just wrong on this one. But that is how the quantum hologram works. It's one of its fundamental properties. And I submit to you, it is the reason that we experience all of our psychic effects non-locally. We have got experiment after experiment after experiment showing non-local effects, but never a mechanism to say how is the information carried. Here's a mechanism that carries the information non-locally. And the information is recoverable through resonance. That's where the MRI machine was set up. And if you happen to know any of the physics and mathematics of an MRI machine, you know that you're dealing with a resonance. Okay. More properties. What comes out of the formalism? It
it's time irreversible. In other words, a quantum hologram that is produced by a physical object doesn't go back. It's not lost. It's time irreversible. There is no time symmetry in the equations. There's no real energy loss because the energy loss is being replaced continuously by quantum fluctuations from the zero-point field. And further, it confirms chaos theory arrow of time. In other words, there is a unique evolutionary history associated with each quantum hologram, which means each one of us and each thing is unique in and of itself. No two physical objects can occupy the same space simultaneously. Therefore, it cannot have a simultaneous or identical history. And if it has a quantum hologram carrying the event history, then each one has to be unique in its path, in its life path, in its history. It also confirms that we live in a 3D spatial universe plus time. There's been a lot of talk about multiverses, multi-universes, etc. There's quite a bit of theory that shows macro scale quantum effects cannot happen in more than four dimensions. Presumably, it can happen at the quantum level, but we do not have any physical proof of that. It's elegant mathematics. The Riemann geometry that Einstein used is elegant mathematics, very sophisticated, very complex, very beautiful, but does it conform to nature? We don't have any proof of that at all. But we do have proof here that at the macro scale level, these quantum effects that we're talking about cannot exist in more than four dimensions. So, nature is primarily as we see it to be, and there's a good reason for that, which we'll go into in a few minutes. Those of you who know a little bit of physics, it fairly well demonstrates that the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, which said at that level it's all probability, and the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, which said at that level every choice branches the universe, those are flawed theories, are not correct. And that should be demonstrated. In fact, it's already been demonstrated to the satisfaction of the colleagues and the people who have peer-reviewed what I'm talking about. What it does validate is the extended transactional interpretation, which says, essentially, there are real physical processes taking place at the quantum level, not just mathematics. It's not just a mathematical model. It is real stuff there. It's energy flowing. What are the major implications that we're talking about here? All physical matter has quantum attributes. The quantum properties, in other words, are not just for subatomic matter, as has been insisted upon for three quarters of the last century, for 75 years, since the beginning of quantum physics. It's been assumed, since Einstein said the moon doesn't go away when you close your eyes, and that's what quantum probability would predict. We're now beyond that. He was wrong, of course. In one sense, the moon doesn't go away when you close your eyes. On the other hand, there's a tiny finite probability that it might. But finding the quantum hologram is showing that is missing the point. The point is that the quantum properties of macroscale matter are represented by the quantum hologram itself. So the quantum hologram is the wave nature of, for macroscale matter, of the famous wave-particle duality which spawned quantum mechanics in the beginning. So let's talk about it this way. We're not talking about subatomic particles, infinitesimal things. We're talking about real stuff here. And we have associated with this real stuff a wave attribute which obeys virtually the same quantum rules that the wave particle duality does at the subatomic level. However, we're talking about macro scale stuff. So essentially what it's saying, we live in a quantum universe. Now this has been debated for 75 years, but we never found the mechanism here. And it is an information carrying mechanism, and that's wow. Elizabeth Rauscher said the other day, I believe, I wasn't here all the time, but this attribute of non-locality that we were talking about.
And I told John that I would go with him, but he didn't talk to me all day yesterday.
And who's John, Kara? What happened to Ryan?
It's precisely what the mystic has said for 1,000 years or so. The universe is somehow mysteriously interconnected. Einstein said it was spooky action at a distance, and that can't exist. Sorry, it does exist. That's the way the universe is structured. What it also is telling us, beneath all our classical descriptions of nature, there are quantum processes at work. Now, let's just take the medical profession, for example, and I don't want to gore anybody's ops here, but we've been trying to get the medical profession for at least 30 years to look beneath the chemical model of treating the body and peddling more pills, and to look at the electromagnetic, the quantum, or what's termed what we would normally call complementary or alternative medicine. And I am very much convinced that most of those techniques are rooted right in the level that we're talking about. So getting beneath those, that chemical model that we've used and had for almost a century now of how the body works to understand and explore the electromagnetic and quantum effects is really what this is all about. Because the QH is likely responsible for most of these subtle energy, numinous effects that we know happen in humans. We just don't have a good explanation for. We haven't discovered those energies, the chi, the zero-point field, all of these things. But the first place we ought to look is with this quantum effects and the interaction of the electromagnetic and the quantum with the macroscale chemical. We'll find very strange interactions here. Just like you've heard about electromagnetic interference, you can't do your cell phone or run your computer when you're in an airplane and it's taking off because of the electromagnetic radiation interactions and interference. Much of what we're seeing, probably in the human aura and these other so-called astral bodies and effects associated with the human body, the human thought, and these are very likely associated with quantum effects or the interaction of quantum effects, chemical effects, and electromagnetic effects. We need to explore that and see if that's the answer. If not, then we have to look for something else. But to me, right now, that is the most likely candidate to explain all the subtle effects that we've been seeing. Okay. Remote viewing by QH. What is it? The object to be viewed, since all physical objects, according to this theory, emits a non-local quantum hologram, which goes rippling off through the universe in the zero-point field. The viewer must have an icon to create a resonance with the object. So all of you remote viewers, either you got to have a name, a set of coordinates, a sock, a piece of clothing, some article that helps you identify with the object to be a remote view. You got to hone in. In other words, that's your receiver. You dial the dial and, okay, you get tuned in. You have to have a way to do that. And the more in tune the resonance, the more complete the information. Now, if our modeling of the quantum hologram is correct, when I say more in tune, it is not just the brain that gets in tune, although that's fundamental. The more you can get in tune, you can get the whole body or whole significant portions of the brain body in tune. And the more you get in tune and the better you are at it, the more complete the information you can pull out of the remote object. But let's understand something here. The quantum information is never complete in itself. We can never totally, as you know, with any sort of intuitive information, you need to have a space-time confirmation of that to build your competence to really get the information. Quantum information, based in the particle theory, is mostly spin correlation. That is what is, at the particle level, that is what is non-local. It's spin correlation. Well, it's a little more complicated at that, at the level of macroscale objects. But it is rather clear that all information, total information, is not carried there. Else we wouldn't need the normal senses. It is complementary information. So you're always going to need to hone your intuition with real-time, space-time, physical, sensory information. And the more you do that, the more you can rely upon it. However, in this theory, if the upper limit to resonance should result in an out-of-body experience, if the body is so totally in resonance with a remote object, you should feel like you're right there. Now, there's some reasons within the mathematical formalism of the quantum hologram that makes us believe that. It is page specific. In other words, it doesn't get mixed up. It is very specific information. Noise tends to make it more clear and more definitive. So there's some very good technical, mathematical reasons why what I'm saying is true. And the more you get focused and in tune with more of the brain-body organism involved with the project itself, you could very well feel a total out-of-body experience. Now, I'm going to tell you about a surprising case history that's come out of this. How many in this room have heard of the Delawar machine from England? A few of you. George Delawar was an engineer back in the 40s and 50s, a British engineer. His wife was a remote viewer. He called him her sensitive then. And very, very good. And he was determined to try to get science involved with this 60 years ago. And he was successful.
Patty, you've lost 30 pounds. Was this hard for you?
I could not believe how easy it was.
But of course, he was way, way ahead of his time. He got laughed out of the scientific establishment, called a fraud, cheating, et cetera, et cetera. But he, nevertheless, he continued his work. Just in the last year and a half, some of that work has been revisited. A group has purchased the Delawar Labs. And one of the things that remained in the lab were about 9,000 slides from the 1940s and 50s period. Glass slides that the Delawar machine, now what he concocted was a series of dials and things to help his wife, who was the initial operator or sensitive, get in tune with or resonate with the object. And he did many, many thousands of tests on everything from simple materials, elements, chemical elements, to human beings, animals, disease, health, and so forth. He ran thousands and thousands of tests, and he had about, during the period, about 13,000 different slides that he had made of his tests, of which around 9,000 were left. And what he did, some of the tests, the whole series of them, not too much to describe tonight. But of course, some of the tests used an icon, a drop of blood, a hank of hair, or something, for the operator to resonate with. And then they would take a picture. Well, it was just a normal 2D slide, they thought. We had one of my colleagues that was helping writing this paper, a lady by the name of Sue Bender, had some of these 2D slides analyzed using three-dimensional analysis, modern computer software, which wasn't invented until 15 or 20 years ago. Lo and behold, what jumped out as they used the software was three-dimensional encoding of the object that was the specimen of the subject. And you could turn it like in any 3D image on a computer and look at it from all angles, etc. Wow. This is totally mind-blowing. If nothing else, it validated that Dilawar, whatever his machine did, some said his machine was a fake, you know, they didn't accept that Bind was involved with it. Nevertheless, this showed that something worked. And that what worked is he was capturing on a photographic plate three-dimensional encoded images of a remote subject that only had an icon here to create the resonance. That is not only remote viewing, but that's PK involved, creating a video, rather a glass plate film, and with a specimen, an icon, and one of the classic ones we looked at was a wire in a cow's stomach who was sick. And wanted the Dilawars to diagnose what's wrong with my cow. Well, they obviously didn't bring the cow into the laboratory. They brought a sample, a specimen. And we could take, 50 years later, that slide, put it on a computer analysis, turn it around like you were looking at it in real life. It was submitted to for independent analysis to MRI experts at one of the leading universities here, double blind, they didn't know what they were looking at. Said, that's the best MRI image I've ever seen, but how did you get those slices so perfectly? Wasn't MRI slices at all, it was a single slide with three-dimensional encoding. Ladies and gentlemen, the only thing that could have done that in modern theory is quantum hologram. It's the only thing that carries the information and has a distributed property so that the entire information was carried in a drop of blood. Am I getting my point across? That experiment alone was a combination of remote viewing and PK. And the slide analysis using modern software produced 3D encoding on standard two-dimensional slides. So a new thing is coming out of here, out of this quantum holographic theorizing and experimental work. First of all, our classical theory of perception is a gross oversimplification and is simply incomplete. The classical theory says, you know, our five normal senses are sound, sight, taste, touch, and smell. But QH suggests that both classical and quantum information is utilized for perception, that it takes both. And if we're evolved species and perception evolved along with the rest of the complexity in the universe, this non-locality as a ubiquitous information system was around long before planetary environments that allowed sight, sound, smell, touch, and so forth to have evolved. So we would say, and I have written a paper given 2 years ago, peer-reviewed in Belgium, called Nature's Mind, the Quantum Hologram, which explores exactly this issue, that the basis of subjective experience and perception is non-locality. Therefore, we can say that the brain creates the PCAR condition with the object by phase gating, as it were, the quantum holographic information and the space-time signaling coming in through the normal sensory channels. A way to think about this. If I snap my fingers, or you snap your fingers here, where do you hear the sound? You don't hear it in here. You hear it as though it's out here. Well, how in the world does that happen? That's what phase conjugate adaptive resonance means. The brain creates, as it were, a
time, Susanna. Save the best for last at your next meal with our delightful raspberry pavlova. Very impressive dessert. With
virtual signal. And it's the only way you can mathematically model this distance that you hear out here, or reality that we see things where they are in the Cartesian theater of our existence. It's not because of binocular vision, although that enhances the effect. It's because, like bats, like dolphin, like side-looking radar, we put out a virtual signal instead of a real physical signal and echo it back and measure the wave phase relationships in order to see where things are. Why is that important? Because we're in an evolving universe and survival depends upon it. If we weren't able to perceive our reality the way it is, we couldn't survive. The survival advantage goes to the species that perceives and moves in its environment the best. So we have to have these mechanisms. We're just now starting to understand from the quantum level what is the way these mechanisms work. It's also helping us see that the brain is a massively parallel quantum computer, which has been denied for quite a number of years, that the brain is too hot to do quantum processes. Nonsense. We can do it with MRI machines, which are a hell of a lot hotter than the brain at times, then it's not too hot. In other words, some of the ideas of quantum processes working at the quantum level, the subatomic level, are falling by the wayside very, very rapidly right now. They're simply wrong. And it seems that a way the brain does this, and this is a metaphor, the work of Stuart Hameroff, Roger Penrose are very germane to this notion of microtubules. But as you tie it into quantum holographic theory, that the microtubules of the brain act like, metaphorically, an organ pipe that creates a standing wave in the microtubule that we interpret and perceive as a sensory information associated with that particular sense, whether any one of the five senses work the same in that regard. Possible new discoveries coming up from the quantum holographic work. One of the most exciting is that the physical matter is a self-referencing quantum system. Well, what does that mean? It will mean a lot more to mathematicians and physicists than perhaps the rest of us. But holographically, you know about a hologram. If these guys down here on the strip and their shows want to create a holographic image on the stage, they have to have a reference signal that decodes a two-dimensional hologram and thereby creates a three-dimensional image on the stage for you. Or if your car dealer wants to show you a new automobile, but he doesn't have one really in stock, so he shows you a holographic image, he has to have a reference signal that projects it into a three-dimensional reality. So you can see it, but you can't touch it. You can put your hand through it. The quantum hologram is kind of the same thing. It's an image carrying information, a distributed image. But one of the big problems in quantum physics is what's the reference? They haven't really concerned themselves too much with phase. All of a sudden now we're interested in phase. What is the reference? It turns out each individual physical object is its own reference. What does that mean? It's its own zero point. Used to graphing something, you have to have a datum, x, y coordinates and a zero point. Every physical object is its own zero point for the emission of the quantum holographic waves. This has a very powerful implication, and some of you may understand this word, certainly physicists and mathematicians will. It seems to solve this notion of self-referencing, seems to solve a very thorny problem in cosmology and quantum physics called renormalization. And I've touched this with this to a couple of people in the community, and they say, wow, if that really works, you've explained something very powerfully. And we now know the reason for that. It has to do with this phase problem. That if you didn't, that the phase was arbitrary and we had an arbitrary constant in many physical equations that you had to subtract out arbitrarily to make the numbers come out right. They didn't know why. It said something's wrong with the mathematics, but no one ever knew what. Now it appears it has to do with the quantum hologram and the arbitrary phase of a self-referencing system. If you say it's a self-referencing system, you know how to subtract out this arbitrary constant. Out of all of this, it is totally consistent with the idea when you think of a divine universe and such creating, learning, evolving universe. God sleeps in the minerals, awakens in plants, walks in the animals, and thinks in man, which comes from a very ancient Sanskrit proverb. Thank you very much. You've been a wonderful audience.
It's absolutely brilliant. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for joining me here today, everybody. Please come see me tomorrow. Namaste.